be here on our celebration of 40th birthday. I am standing here to be my birthday, of course, and you can quite understanding in your early years you have had my own birthday at ISM Council. More recently, I'm very aware of you supporting ISM in its campaigns for music education. And in particular, you're chairman elected already of our ISM Council, so there's a long history of cooperation between the two organisations. On a personal level, I'm particularly pleased to be talking to you in this city, which is where, in my student days, I first discovered the joys of performing. So, congratulations from the ISM to you on your 40th birthday, and we look forward to many 4 years of collaboration. The title of your conference, Celebrating the Past into the Future, I have to say, keeping in mind of my student days here when I studied history and the dreaded compulsory paper in our final year of exams, known as the General History paper, where we were asked to in general terms of what 3 years of studying history has taught us about how the world works. And the typical example question that was always given was, if people learn by their mistakes, why does history repeat itself? Now, if you're celebrating the past, it probably means that there are new mistakes that you need to learn from. So I'll concentrate on the future, and I hope in this talk I'll do a quick, it's going to be a counter through a number of current business and legal issues, and I hope there'll be something for each one of you which might help you to make the future even brighter. I'll be covering a number of topics. First of all, the importance of written contracts. Then, our tips on how to set your teaching rates. Something about employed as opposed to self-employed status for your work at school. Then, choosing the right business structure for you. Child protection issues and the latest thinking on that. And then, briefly touching on our current campaigns for music education. So first of all, get it in writing. That's the first mantra of my talk. It is very important always to get every piece of work accompanied by a written contract. This is important because it makes very clear what your rights and obligations are. Conversely, it means that the person who's engaging you to do the work is clear as to what their obligations and rights are to you. It also importantly reduces the scope for later argument as to exactly what terms were agreed. For some years I was involved in our in-house legal support work for our members, and I can tell you that the greatest problems we found that our musician members encountered were situations where the terms of the contract had not been agreed at the start, and so the contracting parties were arguing as to what had been agreed, and they were the most difficult cases. What should go into a contract? These are just 5 examples of the main things I think should go into a contract. It should stipulate what work is required of you. It should say how long the lessons are going to be for. It should say when the lessons are going to take place and where they're to take place. Importantly, it should clearly stipulate your fee, the amount of the fee, when it's due for payment, and who is going to pay it. I've come across cases where grandparents have paid for music lessons for their grandchildren, but the music teacher's contract is with the parents. Now, that can lead to difficulties because the parents say, well, I never intended to pay this, and that it's my parents who are paying it, I can't afford the fees. Now, it might be better in that situation, actually, to have the contract with the grandparent who's paying than with the parents. Always the subject of some difficulty. Every contract should have make it clear what happens when lessons are missed and what payment is required and expected of you, because you will have set aside that part of your valuable time to give that lesson. Finally, it should set out what notice is required to terminate the contract. So, what contract should you use? There are a number of possibilities. For ISN members, we have a template teaching contract which can be downloaded from our website. The back, it's two pages of A4. The second page looks rather forbidding. It's in small print and in very legal terms. But actually, it's the front page that's important, with lots of blanks to fill in when the lessons are given, what the fee is, what and when the payment of the fee is due. It's very easy to use. It can also be amended by individual teachers to suit their particular needs by just making a manuscript amendment to the contract, which is initialed and dated by both yourself and the parent or adult pupil with whom you are entering into the contract. Of course, a lot of schools provide their own template contract for their visiting music teachers to use, and they're often absolutely fine. You can draw up your own contract if you're feeling brave. But I think another point to remember is that even an email exchange covering all the essential points of the contract can have legal validity. So that's setting contract. Next thing I wanted to talk about was setting your teaching rates. You will have this handout on your seat, which is our results of our MDP's information service. But first of all, the second mantra of the day, which is know your market value. This is really common sense. If you charge too much, you're going to lose pupils. If you charge too little, you're going to lose out on money which you could otherwise earn. So what it means is you have to be very aware of what other music teachers are charging. And this is why our annual teachers' fees survey can be very helpful. We commission it annually, and teachers tell us what they were charging in September of each year, which is the start of the academic year. In the last survey, we attracted almost 1,200 responses, and we believe that this survey is a unique but a quantitative indicator of what music teachers are charging. And this handout summarises our latest results. You can see fees reported to us all have quite a wide range. So we report the sort of the central range and also the midpoint of all the fees reported to us. We also know from the surveys we've carried out, they've consistently shown that rates are higher in London than elsewhere in the country. But elsewhere in the country, there's not much overall variation from region to region between southwest or northeast, for example. We also know if you're teaching in schools that independent schools, fee-paying schools, pay much more than other schools. So what we do is we publish rates for London, outside London, and by the different types of school to give you some idea of what the going rate was start of each academic year. These results are available to everyone on our website if you want to keep yourself updated. This chart, I call it my head falls chart, actually, because it shows, I think, that music teachers have shared in the general austerity of the past 5 years. You'll see the sort of purpley red line that's going right up to the top. That's the consumer price index. The yellow line shows what's happened to average wages in the country over the same period. So that you can see that in real terms, after allowing for inflation, average wages have actually fallen quite significantly. That's the gap between consumer price and average wages there. And what's been happening to this is music teachers' rates, as suggested by our survey. As the orange line shows employed visiting music teachers' rates, they've done slightly better than average wages. The blue line shows private teachers who perhaps come close to average wages. What you can't see, because it's flatlining right along the horizontal axis, is self-employed visiting music teachers. They have not done, I'm afraid, so well. They have been flatlining even in money terms. Now, if I had a crystal ball, and I would try and say what's going to happen over the next few years. Well, we all know consumer prices are now flatly down to virtually zero, so the purple line is probably going to start to become more horizontal over the next year or two. By contrast, average wages have been rising, started to rise rather more strongly. So the gap between consumer prices and the average wages is narrowing. Perhaps that means that music teachers, including singing teachers, would be able to start charging a bit more. Let's hope so. This is about using asking the survey. Where do you fit? I quite often get asked this by individual music teachers, and I always deliberately avoid giving an answer, because I don't know, they have to make the commercial judgment themselves. But these are things that you might want to allow for in deciding where you fit within the range of these shown by our survey. As we've already mentioned, geographical location. Are you in London? Are you somewhere else in the country? Within your area, are you in a relatively prosperous area, or are you in a less prosperous area? Your status, are you employed or self-employed? And I'll speak a bit more about that in a few minutes. Who are you working for if you're working in schools? Is it a fee-paying school where rates tend to be higher, or a state school? The general economic situation and inflation, which we've already talked a bit about, when things are looking good, it may be that you can put your rates up a little bit more. You also should take into account inflation, because if you don't adjust for inflation, while inflation is at imperious when inflation is more than this current zero, your earnings are going to fall in real terms. You also need to take into account your personal qualifications and experience. Our surveys have consistently shown that the more experienced and highly qualified teachers are able to charge higher rates than less experienced younger teachers. Also, you might like to think, how much do I need to get more work? It always strikes me that a young music teacher just starting out will be very keen to get more pupils. And perhaps would be inclined to charge rather less than someone perhaps approaching retirement who's actually winding down. And they may already having established themselves, they may have a waiting list. This seems to me an opportunity for them to be prepared to charge relatively more and have a nest egg for their retirement. Final point is the level you're teaching. Now, I think this could be a little bit controversial. I know some music teachers who do charge more if they're teaching grade 6, 7, 8 that when they charge for pupils to whom who are beginners or grade one, two, other teachers take the view that they're applying the same skills to both levels of teaching, and in fact the earlier level often in some senses requires even more skills, and so would not charge a differential. But that's something that perhaps might be worth bearing in mind. Moving on now to employed as opposed to self-employed status. At ISM we often get questions, am I self-employed or employed in a particular piece of teaching work at schools? It's a complicated and difficult question to which there's no simple answer, because there's no, in legal terms, there's no single determining factor of your status, and people and employment tribunals would take into account quite a wide variety of factors in deciding whether someone is employed or self-employed. These are some of the obvious ones. If your tax is deducted under PAYE and you're paying Class 1 national insurance, the likelihood is that you are indeed employed. Similarly, if you're entitled to sick pay and holiday pay, it's very likely that you will be employed. If you are entitled to send deputies in to do the teaching at your own choice, you are probably self-employed. Finally, if you are taking on the financial risk of the business, you are probably self-employed. The obvious example here is if you bill the parents directly and you are responsible for collecting their payment, you are taking on the financial risk of not being employed. If a payment comes to you via the school who pays you and then recharges the parents, that's a different situation, and that would suggest a situation of employment. The final thing to note is, because we find schools often claim this, that they claim that they have to charge visiting music teachers a room hire charge to demonstrate the teacher's self-employed status. At ISM, we don't believe that this is correct. It might be one indication of self-employed status, but these are probably more important factors to take into account. Advantages of being employed. It's probably fairly obvious and familiar. Employees get holiday pay, they're paid when they're sick. In many and growing number of situations, the employer contributes to some sort of pension pot for them. And then there are all the other statutory employment rights, protection against unfair dismissal, maternity rights, and a right to redundancy payments. So there are a lot of advantages of being employed. But self-employed teachers are certainly paid more. Our surveys have tended to suggest that they're paid almost £2.50 an hour more than employed visiting music teachers. When I saw this, I personally asked the question, is this differential actually too small when you take account of all the factors, all the other factors, because that employees are having Class 1 national insurance paid for them by their employer, there's holiday pay, there's sick pay, and they may get a pension contribution from their employer. Is a £2.50 differential adequate to compensate self-employed VMTs for that? I asked the question. Finally, our survey in this section, our survey results show that there are a growing number of visiting music teachers are in fact employed. The blue bars are employed VMTs, the red ones are self-employed VMTs, and you see that since 2009, the proportion of our survey respondents who are employed has risen from 35% to just over 40%. So I guess by the time you have your 50th birthday, if this trend continues, we'll be able to say that the majority of visiting music teachers in schools are actually employed. Business structure is another thing we're often asked about. What is the right business structure for you? I have a music teaching business, but should I be setting up a company? I work with some other musician colleagues, should be going into a partnership. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that. If you're not set up in a company or as in a partnership, you are a sole trader. The big advantage of that is that you have personal control over everything, and there's minimal reporting. All you have to do is submit an annual tax return. Sorry, perhaps I take back the word all. You retain all the profit of your business, and you can do with it what you like. The big disadvantage is you have unlimited personal liability when things go wrong. You have unlimited liability for any debts and payments, obligations that you incur. And of course, you suffer the blow when your clients don't make the payments due to you. If you set up a company, the company will take on that liability, and it's a limited liability company, so the total liability of the company is limited to the amount that the shareholders put in, so that you have that reassurance that not only is the liability limited, but it's the liability of this company, it's not your personal liability, your own home is not at stake. You also have the potential to raise external funding. It's easier to borrow from a bank if you have company status than it is as an individual. The main disadvantage is that there are much more onerous reporting requirements. You have to register in the company's house, produce an annual return, and obviously there are costs there in terms of time and probably your accountant's fees. There also may be tax implications, depending on the current tax regime and where precisely you fit. A partnership is probably somewhere in between the two. Then also, sometimes we're asked, should I be setting up a charity? A charity, like a company, probably creates the potential for obtaining funding, particularly from grant-making trusts, towards a particular musical project. But I suspect it's not really suitable for a suitable structure for your, if you like, your main day job, your basic teaching work, because you very much lose control of it. To set up a charity, you have to have an independent board of trustees who control the work of the charity. And also, all the charity's activities have to be consistent with charity law, which restricts what charities can do to a number of charitable purposes and require the charity to show that it is for the general public benefit, not for the benefit only of you as a music teacher. So my feeling is that a charity is maybe a suitable structure if you've got a particular project for a festival or whatever, which you're working on with colleagues as a way of raising external funding. But it's not for your sort of, not the day job work of music teaching. So deciding on your business structure, I would suggest there are three questions to ask. One is, how much risk am I taking on? The more the risk, the more you want to avoid that unlimited personal liability. For instance, you probably wouldn't want to engage as an individual to hire the other four for the concert you're promoting, and taking on the risk of not selling any tickets but still having to play the other musicians. If you were in an ensemble, my understanding is quite often there's one member of the ensemble who is responsible for arranging the gigs, receiving the payment for the gigs, and then passing on their share to the other musicians. There's a lot of money going through that individual's bank account. They might want to suggest to their colleagues that they set up a partnership in order to limit that individual's personal liability. Also think, am I looking for external funding? Final question, for the delight of every accountant, what would be the tax implications for setting up a company? This would be different in every case. I have heard an accountant with many years' experience of doing the accounts of self-employed musicians say that probably it's not even worth thinking about setting up a company if your turnover is less than £80,000 a year, and that even if it is higher than that, it still may not be worth it. But ask the accountant. But I think that's really just one piece of advice. Moving on to child protection issues. I think the first thing I want to say is that I firmly believe that 99.99999% of music teachers are total, there's no way they're involved in any inappropriate business with children. But the second thing I want to say is, as a music teacher with frequent one-to-one access to children, you just can't be too careful at present in what you do and don't do. A few tips by the purloined from our safeguarding experts at ISM. First thing they wanted me to point out was there are a number of types of abuses. We're not just talking about sexual abuse. There's emotional abuse, when a child is constantly belittled and made to feel totally lacking in confidence. There's physical abuse, obviously, hitting, injuring physically. I don't think I need to explain that. There's also neglect. If a child is not getting the attention and the support and care that, as a child, he or she needs. So it's a wider concept than just sexual abuse. A few tips on what to do if a child starts telling you about that they're being abused. This is a very serious situation which must be taken very seriously. We say you should listen very carefully to what your child is saying and try to understand exactly the point they're trying to get across. Don't lead the conversation. Let the child take their own time to tell their story and to tell it in their own way. And certainly don't ask questions which, don't ask leading questions, if you like, which are clearly asking for a specific answer. Let them take the time to let the child tell the story in the way they want to. The child will also need reassurance that they've done the right thing. It must be a very hard thing for a child to speak to an adult about this sort of thing, and they will need reassurance. But they will also need to be told from the outset that this information, you will have to share this information, but that you will be sharing it only with people who need to know. Once the conversation is finished, we strongly recommend you make a written record of what was said. And then, of course, you should report the conversation. If the conversation has arisen in a school conduct context, there should be the appointed safeguarding mechanism in the school who would be the person to report it to. If it's raised in the context of private home-based teaching, we suggest that the first thing you should do really is call the NSPCC helpline to ask them. They're very experienced at advising people what to do and whether it's something that should be reported to the local authority, social services. If you're an ISM member, you can also contact our safeguarding team, who will be able to advise you on the next steps. A few words of warning. Question of physical contact, music teaching. often a very difficult one. Some people, I think, have said that there should be no physical contact whatsoever. I'm very we and I said are very conscious that for some instruments, including voice, that can create some difficulties. And we would say that in some limited circumstances, physical contact may be appropriate, but only in limited circumstances, and only if the parent's consent to this physical contact has been obtained first, and only if the parent and the pupil have explained to them what is going to happen and why it is necessary. I had some singing lessons many years ago, and I remember my teacher, because I was pretty bad at reading, my teacher was very keen to put her arms around my stomach to help teach me how to breathe. Before she did this every time, she asked me if she might do it, and she explained exactly why she was doing it. I had no... I was an adult at that stage, but that seemed to me a very reasonable way of dealing with the situation. And I think the parents must know in advance, too. Use of the internet and social media with children can be a dangerous minefield, I think, for the teachers. And I think the general advice is always keep your relationship with your pupil on a strictly professional basis. Don't do anything which might suggest you're trying to cultivate a friendship. Be very careful about using emails and mobiles to contact your pupils. Never use the sort of the wider social media like Facebook. And then also think about if you're advising a pupil to use the internet in their teaching, think about whether it's appropriate. And I think the answer must be, if you're doing any of these things, get parents' permission beforehand. I can see there may be situations where it's useful to have a pupil's email or mobile number if you can contact them to say that you're going to be late for a lesson because you're stuck on the bus or whatever. But the answer really is to make sure that you have obtained that email address, that mobile number from that pupil's parents, and to be sure that you don't use it for unnecessary purposes, and certainly nothing which might be deemed inappropriate. Which leads me nicely on to grooming, which is, I suppose, behaviour that could be construed as befriending a child as a prelude to abuse. And the obvious sort of examples are giving a child money or presents, doing favours for a child like moving to his home, and then inappropriate or unprofessional conversations or behaviour. It's important to avoid any of these sort of things and to keep that relationship with your child pupils on a professional, totally on a professional basis to avoid anything being misconstrued. Schools are required to obtain an enhanced DBS check with what's called a barred list check. For every teacher they engage who is involved in what's called regulated activity. And that's roughly speaking regulated activities teaching the child at least once a week or on four or more occasions in a 30-day period. So it's probable that virtually all the work you do in schools is going to be regulated activity. It's also true that outside schools, frequent or intensive unsupervised teaching of children would constitute regulated activity. You are also eligible for an enhanced DBS check if you teach or train children, but not to an extent that constitutes regulated activity. The difficulty for private teachers who don't have any schoolwork is that a DBS check can be obtained only if a specified organisation wants to check on an individual. So at this point, I should mention that the ISO has a facility to obtain DPS checks for members who don't teach in schools but are home-based private teachers, which can be particularly a particularly useful thing to show to parents and reassure them. And all the teachers on our private teachers register and on our directory have obtained an enhanced DPS. It's not cheap. It's currently at £65.60. But the final bit of news on this in this section is relatively good. In 2013, helped partly by lobbying from the ISN, the system for obtaining DBS checks was changed. Previously, every school you worked in would require a check, and you had to get a new check for each school, which was starting to be quite costly for some music teachers who might teach in a number of different schools. The new system allows a DBS certificate to be portable between schools, so that what happens when you apply for your first check, you opt into this DBS update service, which costs only £13 a year, and when subsequently other schools want to ask you for a DBS check, they can just online check it online without your having to go through all the application process again and pay your £65. So that's worth doing, but you must remember that if you get to opt into the update service, you must do so within 19 days of the first DBS being issued. But I think it's well worth it. Finally, I'd like to talk a bit about a couple of the ISM's campaigns for music education. I'm very aware that AOTOS has been very supportive of us in this work. The first is Protect Music Education. We launched this campaign last year when the government was proposing to cut this expenditure on music education to £58 million a year, from, I think, a figure of about £82 million. And we received a lot of support from the music industry, including AOTOS. Over 5,000 individuals signed our petition. And I'm pleased to say the government reversed this decision and agreed to £75 million funding for the current financial year. Obviously, looking ahead, we still need to keep an eye on this and make sure that they don't attempt to cut back again, and we would like to maintain that £75 million spending over the next few years. I think it's at a historically high level of £75 million, so that's good news, but we want to keep it that way. There's also Back for the Future. We launched this campaign in 2012 when the government, Michael Gove, was proposing to exclude music from GCSE league tables and other creative subjects, I should add. What he was proposing was what's known as the English baccalaureate subjects only would be included in those tables. There are five EBAC subjects: English, maths, a science, and a language, and finally history or geography. And we launched a campaign opposing that very narrow curriculum. The worry is, if league tables include only a limited number of subjects, schools will of course concentrate on those limited number of subjects to the expense of others. We received a lot of support on the CBAC campaign, including from AOTOS, and over 46,000 individuals signed our petition. And good news, in February 2013, the government announced that creative subjects could be included in GCSE league tables. They extended the number of subjects that would be included, and among the indications, the possibility of including subjects like music, art, drama, and design technology. So that was good news. But last month, the government seemed to do another U-turn, to announce proposals to make it compulsory for all secondary school children to study all core EBAC subjects. That's the five I've mentioned. So we've just relaunched our Back for the Future campaign. We've already attracted another 6,500 individual signatures, and 40 organisations have reaffirmed their support for the campaign. This is obviously an important current issue, and we thank AOTOS for all their support for our campaign. And we would ask you, as individuals, to sign our online petition. And that's the www.backforthefuture.com. Thank you very much for listening. I've got a few minutes to try to answer any questions.
It's very interesting that you say that being a visitor community is now moving towards almost entirely employed status. And yet there doesn't seem to be any built-in natural rise to the point of experience in the way that academic teachers do. Do you see the ISM being able to help with this changing landscape and actually see that employed teachers are given a natural rise to the experience? And
sorry, I was difficulty hearing.
You mentioned that all BMTs are now being more employed. Mm-hmm. Is there any way the ISM can help with the changing landscape to see that employed visiting music teachers have incremental rises according to their experience in the same way that academic teachers do?
I see, yeah. It's something that we like to do. We do recommend rates for employed visiting music teachers. They're at the bottom of the first page of your handout. Competition law allows us to recommend rates for employed work, but not self-employed work. And we do try to build into those our annual proposals an incremental increase, and we hope our members use those figures to negotiate with schools. But we find, I think the difficulty is a lot of employed BMTs rates are actually not specifically linked to national teachers' pay scales.
Yeah.
But I take the point, I take it back.
Especially this is the way forward in the future.
Yeah, it could be. Of course, it does have the downside when national teachers' pay scale increments are frozen. Yes. So it's not, I think you'd have to think about whether it's necessarily a good thing, because my Ed Paul's chart would suggest actually to employ BMTs have done relatively well over the past 3 years compared to other music teachers and indeed compared to UK average wages.
Yeah.
Can I just ask, if you were a singing teacher, new to the profession, and setting up as a private singing teacher in, say, Huddersfield, is your information available to members local enough for that person to be able to think about fees in relation just to that locality?
No, it isn't. But the reason why we don't publish a more detailed geographical breakdown, so I think I said earlier on, was all the survey statistics and the survey results are analysed by statisticians at the University of Reading, and every year they said there was no statistically significant difference between the rates in Yorkshire and the rates in Cornwall. I would guess that if you say what are the rates in Huddersfield, you probably wouldn't have enough respondents resident in Huddersfield to be making an authoritative statement.
What about their local authority, for example, who leads as a capital?
That's an interesting point. Perhaps we should do a survey. Yeah, the music services as well. What are you paying?
Thank you.
When you ask your questions, could you make sure you're projecting so you can
on, if you buy a franchise, a musical franchise, what is your position? Are you a sole trader? Is it a company? Is it a partnership?
It's probably a, you're probably a sole trader to start off with.
Yes, sometimes, I mean, not that I'm in the situation, but you might pay to take on a musical franchise.
Yeah.
To initially set up that business.
Yeah. You're probably still a sole trader. The question is, I think, who is paying you? Is it the parent still, or is it actually the franchise holder?
Yeah, so what is the advantage? If you're having to pay for the franchise and you're still a sole trader, you're taking on a lot of risk.
Yeah.
Financial risk.
Depends who the franchise holder is.
Right.
And what their situation is.
Right. But presumably they should be there to sort of help you, so there should be some sort of...
Yeah. Perhaps a lot of preschool teachers, doesn't it, and some theatre groups as well.
So my understanding is that it's the teacher is still very much probably a sole trader. Mm-hmm. What they've done in buying the franchise is acquired the rights to use that name and probably teaching tools in their sole trader work. Does that make sense?
Somebody over here.
Hi, thank you. Back to VMTs in schools. A few years ago, you advised me when one of my employer's schools moved its visiting music teachers onto a minimal hour contract, above which we charge for the majority of our work as overtime, thereby minimising their liability for sick and holiday pay. Do you find that this is a trend that you notice across the country?
Not that I'm aware of. It sounds almost as if it's more of a question of our legal team, but until last week I sat in the same office as them, and I certainly didn't pick up anything like that. You know, that sounds like a rather unusual situation.
Right.
No, yes, I only wanted to say that I encourage young teachers in particular in their contracts to put a clause in which allows for raising the fees. I believe, without looking at it at this instant, I believe I say something like 6 weeks' notice of rising fees should be given, would be given, and 4 weeks' notice of termination of contract to cover that area. Because I'm involved with teaching a lot of young teachers who are busy taking diplomas and starting businesses, and they don't start at a very ambitious rate of pay, but I believe if they once manage to get themselves qualified, they have something of a right, and as their business grows, they have a right to raise their fees. And I think that's important to include in the contract.
I totally agree. I think all teachers should review their rates in the compensation class. And
yes.
It doesn't mean we're going to raise your rates every year. And all contracts, all teaching contracts, should have a provision for an annual review of rates. And what you're suggesting about the notice of an increase sounds to be very sensible, because the parent must give the opportunity to decide I can't afford that higher rate and to give them.
Over there in the blue.
Yes. Hi. So, sorry, just going back to contractual obligations, you were talking about the fact that if you had exchange of emails, that would be legally watertight. Is that the same with contracts that aren't necessarily signed? Because quite often they're a bit slapdash about that.
I think you have to get the contract signed.
You do have to get signed.
Yes,
So then you're talking about, but then how does that differ then from the exchange of emails?
I think what I said, exchange of emails is watertight.
Yeah.
What I meant to say was that in the absence of a written signed contract,
yes.
it would be very helpful if there was an exchange of emails saying, these are our terms, the reply was, I agree to them.
Thank you for
that.
Once you are accepted by the update service for DBS and you pay your £13 a year, is that it? You don't have to apply for further
£65.60?
That's it.
You have to pay your £13 a year to be engaged. as I understand it, you've got a reference number, yes, and they can access it online.
No, I think it does depend, because I'm in three establishments, mm-hmm, and one of which is the Sheffield Cathedral, and the diocese did not recognise the updates there.
When was that?
This year. I had a button, and I won, but nevertheless.
Suggestion that one has something to indicate that you can change your fees. I think that's actually part of the ISA contract, isn't it? And you also have as part of, it is actually another form that you can have that you can get parents to sign, which has what your fee raise is going to be, that you send out at the end of the previous term.
Indeed.
That's one of the resources that you have.
Indeed. Our survey results, interestingly, suggest that music teachers raise their fees once every 2 or 3 years, if that helps. But when they do raise them, it's not by 40 cents an hour, it's by a sort of random figure like £1 an hour. And I thought that was sort of quite interesting, to information that came out of the survey.
Sally, thank you ever so much. Are you going to be around for a little bit? So you're going to stay for lunch. So if people have further things or something they want to consult with Sally in a slightly less public arena than in the hall, I'm sure she'll be happy to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming and sharing this very reassuring background that we have behind us in the ISM. Thank you.